Well, hi folks. I'm Colin Farquharson. I'm from Memorial University in Newfoundland. Before that was at University of British Columbia for quite a while. The thing that I've got some experience with is numerical modeling and inversion for EM methods. Alan invited me, asked me if I'd be willing to give a short course on stuff that I hopefully know on EM methods, numerical modeling, during my visit here at DIAS, and yes, I'm very happy to subject you folks to this stuff. So at the moment, it's looking like five classes, perhaps. This is going to be flexible, but the vague idea, I think, and you probably all know this, is to go for these one-hour sessions. They might not last that long. They might last a little bit longer. We'll see. But 2 o'clock today, tomorrow, Thursday, Friday, and next Monday. Certainly, tomorrow, same time, same place for sure. Thursday, Friday, Monday, we might move things around a little bit. We can see how things go. My wife, Kim Welford, is also visiting, working with Brian O'Reilly, so our schedules have to fit both of us, so that's why things might move around a little bit. So in terms of the short course, this is the vague plan. These sort of five lectures, I mean, they're not really lectures. I'm quite happy for these to be nice informal affairs, so for sure I'd be happy to take all sorts of questions or comments during or after. But I've prepared five PDF files that'll be roughly, without any interruptions, it might be 45 minutes or a lot less. But if there's any questions, then it might be approaching an hour. But so I've got these five PDF files prepared that I want to just go through and talk about. Certainly informal, for sure. We'll see how this goes. I've suggested a couple of exercises in here that if any of you are wanting to try, in my mind, they would kind of be good things to have a go at. They're not too big by any means. They're just 1D problems. They do illustrate a little bit some of the issues that arise when you're doing numerical modeling of EM on all scales, 2 and 3D as well. So as well as I could imagine, they're pretty useful and yet doable-sized exercises, should you be wanting to do that. I've got some Fortran source code, because I did code up 2 out of the 3 examples. I didn't do all of them, I must admit. So I've got code for 2 of them, and I'm perfectly willing to share that code with you if you're interested. Some of you might not be using Fortran, which would be unfortunate, but if you do want to use MATLAB or something modern, then I guess that will work too. And sure, I'm here for all the way through to a week on Tuesday, and again, depending on how our schedules work, I'd be happy to talk more or less about this stuff at any moment. So that's a vague plan. In terms of the five classes, today I want to talk about 1D. Essentially, I want to try and get to the stage where we can actually do something if we're so inclined. So rather than perhaps going through all the techniques or in an organized manner, I kind of want to dive in a bit to 1D. So we'd be in the position to write some code to solve the 1D MT forward modeling problem if we wanted. Then sort of to go back and spend the other 4 classes looking a bit about Maxwell's equations and the other rules for EM, just because in the context of numerical modeling there are certain questions, because everything with numerical modeling is an approximation, and so we cannot end up with an approximate field that satisfies all the rules and regulations for EM. So we're going to have to throw out something, and it's nice if we can do that in a deliberate kind of a way, just to make sure that we're not losing some critical information when we go from true fields to approximate fields. Then I just want to briefly go through sort of the finite difference technique, finite element technique, and I do want to cover the integral equation technique, a bit of a classic, but still relevant, arguably. I will mention the multidimensional case in these situations, but even in here, I'm going to rely quite heavily on sort of the 1D problem, because that it's really easy to visualize what's going on, and it's conceivable to construct an exercise that we can code up in half an hour or a couple of hours to demonstrate things. So there'll be not really a huge amount of talk of the latest and greatest 3D ways that are around in these methods, but I will mention it, and we'd be happy to talk about these outside the classes. Today, at this little session, talk about the 1D problem. And just to, for the next few slides, half dozen or a dozen slides, just kind of sort of powering through here to try and get to the stage of writing code if we wanted to get to that stage. And so initially, just starting off where we always start off with Maxwell's equations. Actually, just since this is a class, not a lecture, quick survey. Who in the room here are working on EM issues? Because it's most. Is it everybody? Not quite everybody. Most. As always, start with Maxwell's equations. And in terms of numerical modeling, most of the time it's the two curly equations. So first off, starting with Maxwell's equations, curl of the electric field equal to the time rate of change of the magnetic field for Faraday's law of induction. So if we start with that one, in a very standard procedure here, take the curl of both sides of this expression. Sneak in here the constitutive relation between B and H to turn this B into our mu naught H right away. I'm assuming that my permeability here is uniform, is independent of position, because I've snuck it through the curl. So right there, we're making assumptions about what problem we're considering. Then use Ampere's law that curl of H is equal to J. Use that to eliminate H from this equation, get J into here, and then using Ohm's law, J equals sigma E, to eliminate J from this equation to give me my sigma electric field here. So this now is my second order partial differential equation in my electric field. And so that's very sort of common starting point for actually doing the numerical modeling, given some connectivity structure represents the Earth, and if we want to have to figure out what the electric field is. So this equation will appear quite a lot. That's properly in 3D, and essentially the only approximation so far is constant permeability. Here, though, I'm heading towards a 1D problem, so setting out all the other assumptions that are going to be made. For sure, almost the definition of our 1D problem, connectivity is going to vary with one spatial dimension, so in our case, let that be Z. We're also going to assume that our electric field is only varying in the Z direction. Also, because 1D, any spatial derivatives with respect to X and Y are going to be zero as well, so they're going to magically drop out of our partial differential equation. And you know, electromagnetic fields, vector fields, so we also have to consider what direction our electric field is going to be pointed in. So let's assume that we've got our electric field purely in the X direction. Excuse me. So this is the whole list of assumptions, simplifications for this 1D problem that we're then going to deal with. And heading very much towards calculating the electric field that we need to calculate if we're looking at the MT problem. So far, so good in terms of 1D MT problem. For it to properly be an MT problem, then we essentially consider a plane wave source coming straight down from above, perhaps. And the most usual way to do that, to implement the source in numerical modeling, is to actually just go with boundary conditions, so not have a source within our domain of interest with this along the z-axis. Just assume that, let's say, the magnetic field up at the top is 1, and then it vanishes to 0 at the bottom. So we're going to deal with our source term that's generating this electromagnetic field in terms of boundary conditions, actually. Excuse me, instead of actually having a source term in there. So that then, by the bottom of this slide, we're now for sure explicitly thinking of the 1D magnetotelluric problem and wanting to calculate the electric field for it. Oops, excuse me. And so this is just going through in sort of painful detail. Well, okay, we've got this 1D situation, derivatives in the x and y direction are going to be zero, so how does that impact our differential operator with the curl? Basically means that we end up with the curl of this 1D electric field that's pointed in the x direction ends up itself just having an x component, the second derivative of our electric field with respect to z. So in this simplified situation, 1D MT situation, this then becomes the, and it should really be an ordinary differential equation, but I put partials all the way through. So this now is the differential equation we have to solve in order to figure out what our electric field is for this 1D MT problem with appropriate boundary conditions. So this is a continuous case, nothing approximate or numerical or discrete so far. So in terms of doing numerical modeling in this specific 1D situation, we have to get things in a situation into a state that a computer can deal with them, and that really basically means getting things in terms of lists of numbers that the computer can do its arithmetic on. So we're going to have to take our electric field and our connectivity distribution and discretize them, come up with a way to represent those in terms of just strings of numbers. And first off, I'm going to worry about sort of discretizing the Earth. I mean, nothing here is going to be too difficult, but it's good to be explicit in terms of what we're doing as we step towards actually doing a numerical solution. And for this case, for this 1D example, I'm going to discretize the Earth in terms of a set of horizontal uniform layers. And okay, I'm drawing my z-axis here horizontally instead of downwards, just because it fits easier on the picture here. But essentially, dividing it up into n layers. So this would be layer 1, layer 2, layer 3. I'm going to use z underscore 1 to represent the z coordinate of this interface, z underscore 2 for the z coordinate of that interface, and so on. So here in this picture, those z's are the interface coordinates. And then just labeling the connectivity in each layer by sigma subscript I for the connectivity in layer I. So that would be between zi and zi plus 1. So already having to start to worry a little bit and explicitly worry about the details of what's going on in terms of these subscripts and keeping track of which connectivity is in which layer and which z coordinates correspond to the top and bottom of each layer, because when it comes to writing the code to do this numerical modeling, then essentially that's kind of the most important part, is just to keep track, all the bookkeeping to keep track of which number corresponds to what in these lists of numbers. So this is going to be our 1D Earth model for this 1D problem, uniform layers. So then we have to discretize the electric field, somehow turn it into a big sequence of numbers that we're going to work with, get the computer to calculate and generate. And so here there's starting to be some choices to be made that in the 1D problem are not much of a big deal, but the corresponding situation in 2 or 3D are worth thinking about. So here, in terms of coming up with a sequence of numbers that's going to represent my approximate electric field, I'm going to go with this situation. I'll do it another way later on. But here I'm going to start saying, okay, I'm going to pick the center of each layer. So these are going to be my nodes, which don't have any z-coordinates just yet. But I'm going to pick these nodes, and I'm going to say that, okay, I'm going to specify my approximate electric field in terms of its value at these nodes. And so subscripts still continuing here and trying to be really careful so I can keep track of which electric field is where. But so, for example, E subscript I minus a half is the electric field that's kind of half a subscript below Z subscript I. E I plus a half is kind of half a way towards Z I plus 1. So this is one way of thinking of the nodes slap bang in the center of each layer. And so then, when it comes down to actually doing the numerical solution, the whole sort of point is to try and calculate, figure out what those values are for those electric fields. And that's not the only way to do it, but it's the way I'm going to do it in this initial 1D example. Right here, I'm sliding towards a finite difference method. At this point, when you're discretizing the field, if you're thinking of a finite element method, you would do something differently. So now, discretized the Earth model, discretized the electric field. What does this mean for our differential equation, this governing differential equation that's telling us what our electric field is going to be doing? Well, this stuff is going to be, or is seemingly going to be trivial, so I'll leave that at the moment. I mean, the biggest thing we're going to have to figure out here in terms of a discretized situation is what does this derivative turn into when I want to consider my discretized electric field? And so I'm going to consider one particular situation, and I'm going to consider things. So this little segment of my model where we're going to center things on this particular node, sort of half an index beyond I, so I plus a half, sitting between zi, zi plus 1, and I'm going to have to consider these other two neighboring nodes on either side. So this is sort of the mini little bit of my z-axis that I'm going to look at and try and figure out what I'm going to have to do to this derivative now that I'm going to try and get into my discretized realm. So just kind of repeating this line up here just to keep track of the indices and what goes with what. And so really, from first principles, I'll talk more about this later, but hey, we kind of all know that spatial derivative That's just like taking the value of our electric field at two neighboring points and divide by the distance between them. That's kind of the fundamental concept of a derivative. And I guess if one did the limiting business as these two points got nice and close to each other, then hey presto, we come up with our derivative. So let's go with this as, hey, let's call that an approximation for our derivative, just this finite difference. So that seems like an appropriate thing to do, a good thing to do to approximate what's going on. Just keeping track of the subscript here, if I'm going to be thinking of trying to approximate the derivative at zi, so here, and maybe it will become clearer as to why I'm doing that later on, but if I want to approximate the derivative here, then it's kind of natural to involve the electric field on the two sides of this particular location and the distance between those two nodes. So that will give me a finite difference approximation for the derivative at this point. Likewise, I can use a finite difference approximation between these two points, these two nodes, that will give me an approximation for the derivative right on this layer interface, halfway between those two nodes, the way I've drawn it here. Just in terms of notation, I'm going to, for this example, assume uniform layers, uniform thickness. That's simply just to ease writing here with all the subscripts. The stuff that follows doesn't have to have uniform layer thickness. So this is just for writing stuff out. So that was the first derivative. I mean, we need to figure out our second derivative and how to approximate it. So now let's consider, okay, try to approximate second derivative centered on our point of interest. And so just using, okay, let's go with our finite difference approximation. So if we're centering things here, if we take the difference between the first derivative here and the first derivative there and divide by the separation between them, hey, that gives us our finite difference approximation to the derivative. So that's kind of what I'm doing in this step here. But then on the previous slide, I already set up what the approximations were for the derivative here and the derivative there. So they just come into this statement here. So at the bottom of all this, assuming uniform layer thickness, this then becomes a statement involving differences in the electric field, a statement that approximates the second derivative respect to z of the electric field centered on this node in the middle of this diagram. And so this nice, straightforward, simple expression, it involves the electric field on either side, and it involves so the two neighboring nodes on either side, and it involves the various separations involved. And so hopefully, I mean, the way I'm setting this up at the moment is just sort of intuitive, kind of relying on, oh, the math that we did a long time ago and what sort of what a derivative actually means. So really just intuition at the moment. The third one, when I talk about finite difference methods properly, I'll come back and do that with slightly more rigor, arguably more rigor. But at the moment, just intuitive. Excuse me. So if we go back to our differential equation for the electric field, and instead of the second derivative, the d2 by dz squared of our electric field, substitute in now this finite difference approximation, then we've got this expression that involves the electric field at three neighboring nodes. And then if this term in here, okay, let's kind of just, it was the electric field and it was the connectivity, I'm imagining this derivative to be centered on this node. So when we're approximating this term in the differential equation, let's just stick in here for the electric field at that node. Seems sensible, hopefully. And for this connectivity, hey, well, this node, by no accident, is sitting right slap in the middle of this layer, which is connectivity sigma subscript I. So this term in here, the I omega mu sigma E term, we can approximate it by using these two terms from our sequences of numbers, from our discretization of the Earth and the electric field. So this here now is an approximation for our electric field differential equation. Involves simply just numbers, and so that conceivably can get treated by a computer to somehow solve that. In terms of what's going on here, I kind of want to go through this in detail just to give you everything you need in case you want to code this stuff up. Just to rearrange things, I mean, e subscript I plus a half is appearing here, so we'll just rearrange this, move stuff around to collect the electric field terms. So that's the only thing that's happening here. So we've got the coefficient of ei plus a half, involves a finite difference term, involves the connectivity, and then the two neighboring electric fields on either side, so just moving stuff around. So this equation came about by looking at this particular node, looking at how one approximates the second spatial derivative at that node, and also perhaps the connectivity term. So everything about this equation is thinking about is centered on that particular node. So you can go through the whole exercise again for, say, this node and come up with a completely comparable expression. If you're centering things around this node, then your second order derivative is going to be centered on this thing. So the EI minus a half is going to be the thing out front of this big stuff in parentheses. Then it's going to be this EI plus a half, EI plus a half is on this side, E minus 1.5 from this node over here. So this gives us a finite difference approximation to our differential equation that's centered on this node. Likewise, we could do the same stuff and come up with an expression centered on that node. So thereby, we're approximating our partial differential equation at a whole number of locations throughout our domain. And basically, we're going to get one of those equations for almost all the nodes. And so that's going to start heading towards a set of simultaneous equations that we can potentially solve. This is just lining things up. I'm effectively heading towards a matrix equation here, and I just want to make it very clear where things are going to go. So these are just the three approximations for this differential equation, with each of these equations centered on a different node. These equations, like e subscript I plus a half is appearing in all three terms here. EI minus a half is appearing here and here. E to the I plus 3/2 is here and here. So there's definitely a bit of a structure happening. And again, just emphasizing the structure, because it's from that structure, the way things line up, that you get your matrix equation, your system of equations. So this, again, is just repeating that same threesome of equations. Now just putting a little square as those coefficients, and just emphasizing the structure. These are three equations in five unknowns at the moment for this little segment of the line. But we can certainly just rewrite those equations in terms of this sort of a matrix equation, where we stick all the values of our approximate electric field at the nodes into one big vector. Right at the moment, I'm only thinking of five nodes. So I've got five numbers in here for the electric field. And then this would be the structure of the matrix that I would need, such that this matrix times this electric field gives me my set of approximate differential equations. And all this at the moment has got zeros on the right-hand side, because doing this 1D problem, and we're going to get the source term in via boundary conditions. So this is just repeating what I just said. If I could do this for, if I do it for all the nodes except for the very bottom one in the very bottom layer, and for the one at the very top layer, we'll ignore this thing at the moment. So if I do that for all of those n minus 2, so I'm assuming I've got n layers, if I do it, then I get n minus 2 equations like this that line up. They involve all the electric fields, including the electric field at the very bottom layer and in the very top layer. So I've now got a system of equations that approximates my differential equation. There's n minus 1 layers, and I'm considering there's n minus 1 nodes in total, and I'm considering all but two of them, all but that one and this one, so that gives me my n minus 3 equations in the system. It does involve all the values of the electric field, which is n minus 1 values of the electric field, so we don't quite have enough information yet to solve this, but of course that's where the boundary condition information is going to come into this. In terms of actually doing that, how do we sort of do that in our approximate world? That's where this extra little ghost node that's floating off the end here, outside the domain, that's going to come in. For the 1D MT problem, the typical way of doing this with boundary conditions, certainly at depth, we just assume that we're going to have our mesh low enough, deep enough into the ground, that we can assume that, yeah, things have decayed to zero at that stage. So the electric field at the very bottom, at z equals infinity, is going to be zero. We're in our discretized world. The bottom of the mesh, the bottom of the stack of layers, does not go to infinity by any means, but I'm going to assume that This bottom layer here goes deep enough that if I require the electric field here to be zero, my approximate electric field here to be zero, then that's a good enough approximation to the electric field going to zero at infinity. So that's going to be my approximate boundary condition at the bottom, which comes in here, this point, sorry. As for the one at the top, now in order to actually get something happening with my MT problem, I'm getting ahead of myself. In terms of getting that into the system of equations, then I'm going to stick on this extra equation at the bottom here, which is essentially, I want to get into this equation the fact that the electric field here is equal to zero, and so I can introduce that by putting this equation in here, which is essentially saying one times the electric field at that node is going to be equal to zero. So that gives me an extra equation to tag on to the bottom of this system of equations. As for the one at the top, which is where we're actually going to need to have something happen, otherwise we're not going to get any electric field at all. The standard thing to do when modeling the MT method is to just say, okay, let's go at the top of the mesh, and let's say our magnetic field is constant at some specified fixed value. So for example, let's just take our magnetic field, let's take our H field, just to be one in this situation. Get the corresponding boundary condition on the electric field, and that mimics a plane wave source for the MT method. In terms of magnetic field equal to one, through our Maxwell equations, that just simply means a condition on the Z derivative for the electric field, and actually equal to this one over I omega mu naught. So now, for this MT problem, the boundary condition at the top that we're needing to approximate is this thing, so a Neumann boundary condition. In terms of how do we get that in there? Well, we've already worked on getting our approximations for the Z derivatives to approximate our differential equation. We already approximated this by a finite difference, so let's just do the same thing. We'll approximate it by the difference in the values of our approximate field at two neighboring nodes, and let that difference be equal to this non-zero term. And where this actually happens, one common way to do this is to, instead of, okay, so this is the very top of our mesh, and this is arguably the top layer, and top air layer, way up in the sky. Instead of have the difference between these two nodes be equal to that 1 over I omega mu naught, another way to do it is to introduce a little ghost node here, so essentially put in a new node. We're going to have to worry about the electric field here, and just specify that the difference between the electric field at those two values is now equal to our 1 over I omega mu naught. So that's this use of ghost nodes, fairly typical way of implementing boundary conditions in the finite difference method. So that, in terms of this example, in doing this ghost node, that gives me two new equations at the top, one of which is explicitly this difference between the electric field at these two locations being equal to 1 over I omega mu naught. But also, before, when I was doing things, I didn't have an approximation for the differential equation centered at this point. My first equation was for the differential equation centered at this point, involving those three values. Whereas if I now include the differential equation here, it involves this one, this one, this one, so that gives me a second equation along here. So now that I've got these two boundary conditions in here, I now have a system that's got n equations in it, and n unknowns, since I've now got another electric field. So hey, a square system, which we can go ahead and solve. And that will give us our vector of these numbers, which are the approximate electric field at the nodes. Just to show you that it works. So this is an example for a homogeneous half space, 0.01 joules per meter. Air, nice small but non-zero electrical conductivity. This was for 3 hertz. Z equals zero is where the half space starts. This is the bottom of the mesh, where I'm forcing things to be forcing things to be zero. This is the top of the mesh, and forcing the edge field to be one. This is the real part of the electric field at all these nodes. Actually, off the top of my head, I can't remember how many nodes I have. Nice and uniform, probably 100 or 50. And these are the values of the imaginary part. That's on a linear electric field axis. And of course, as soon as it hits the Earth, we get this nice decay of the fields. Plotting it on a logarithmic scale just to see more what's going on. Hits the Earth's surface. change over in sign in the imaginary part, change over in sign in the real part. So that's log of the absolute value of the electric field. Okay, so just before we get too carried away and think it's done, just want to go through some of the details that I've sort of, I've shown you a lot of the details so far to set this stuff up, but just talking about one or two of the other details. Okay, so I was trying to emphasize the structure here of this matrix to indicate how to set it all up, because when writing the code, that's almost the most annoying, the most awkward thing is to just make sure each number goes onto the right part in the matrix. So having a good image in your mind about the structure of the matrix is useful. But I'm not going to write this structure anymore out like that. Let's just think of it in terms of matrices. This thing came from your d2 by dz squared term and the I omega mu sigma term. So it naturally, even the matrix can be thought of as the sum of two terms. And then this is going to be a vector of electric field, and this is going to be the right-hand side. I'm just thinking in terms of those equations, those matrices. Okay, this is just summarizing. Diagonal matrix, the entries in this are just the connectivities and the layers. This is a matrix that involves the finite difference approximation for the z derivatives, and then our vector of the electric fields. So in the frequency domain, which I assumed right off on slide number 3 it was, then that means everything is going to be complex valued. All the numbers that we're going to be dealing with are complex valued. This matrix L is real. The matrix S, which involves the connectivities, are real because I'd factored out that imaginary coefficient I omega mu naught. But the electric fields are complex valued numbers. The right-hand side, well, is an imaginary number, complex valued numbers. So we're having to work with complex numbers. That's not a big deal at all. You can either go with matrix solvers that work with complex numbers, or you can use matrix solvers that just go with real numbers, because it's pretty easy just to factor out the system where you work with that explicitly the real part of the electric field, say in the top half of your vector here, the imaginary part at the bottom half. If you do the same thing for the right-hand side, then the matrix equation breaks down to this form where you've got your L matrix appearing there, minus S and plus S. So that's just factoring out your complex equation into real and imaginary parts. One thing I'm not going to mention again in this course, but it is important in terms of actually doing this for real, especially on big problems, is sparse matrices. So that matrix, well, the matrix S, so it's just a diagonal matrix, and the numbers on that diagonal are the connectivities and the layers. So all the other numbers in that matrix are zeros. So really, there's no point. It would be amazingly inefficient if you construct and store that whole matrix that's 99.9% zeros. Similarly, this matrix L, it's not explicitly diagonal, it's tridiagonal or similar. Again, it's virtually all zeros. So in terms of efficient memory use in any programs, you do not want to be storing all those zeros. You just want to be using store the non-zero numbers, store the location of that number in the matrix, and then just go with that. This has been recognized by a lot of people for a long time. There's a lot of good quality routines out there, numerical routines, numerical libraries that work with sparse matrices that do all the operations you'd ever want to do, really, on sparse matrices, matrix vector products, matrix products, matrix solvers, setting up preconditioners and everything. So for sure, you have to end up doing sparse matrices. And it's absolutely critical for the multidimensional problems, for 3D problems. You'd get absolutely nowhere without working with sparse matrices. In terms of solvers, I do not know much about solvers, so I'm not going to talk much about them here at all. There's two main divisions. There's the classic, the Gaussian elimination LU decomposition. That's quite possibly the way that you learned how to solve a system of equations in school. I think that was the way I ended up being taught that going through high school. It wasn't called that at the time, but looking back, that's exactly how we did it. And factor your matrix into a matrix that has a lower triangular shape and an upper triangular shape. I'm just going through the steps. Once you've done the factorization, and okay, call this ux, another vector, and solve for L y equals b through here to give us y, and then you can solve what you're left with to get us back x. So it basically involves two steps, solving with one triangle matrix and solving with another triangle matrix. And the thing is, at this stage, these solves are very fast, very efficient. Okay, this initial decomposition is not. And so there's good points and bad points about LU decomposition. I mean, the disadvantage from sort of our perspective is that it doesn't work well with sparse matrices. If your matrix A is sparse, but then do an LU decomposition on it, then your L and your U are not going to be sparse. They're going to explode up into full matrices, essentially. So that's a major problem. However, with the LU decomposition, there is always this attractive feature that if we can actually do that decomposition, then it is really efficient to do those triangular solves. And so if you have to solve the same system of equations or the same matrix, but different right-hand sides, and if you can get your LU decomposition, then solving for those multiple right-hand sides then becomes really efficient. So there's this nice tantalizing advantage for LU decomposition methods. And certainly folks are trying to get these kind of methods to work reasonably efficiently for sparse matrices. The other way is iterative solvers. And I'm not going to mention much about those at all. Essentially, those are just some way of finding a sequence of vectors that eventually are going to converge to an adequate solution of your problem. So in other words, hopefully iterate towards gradually improving this vector x such that if we pre-multiply by our matrix, look at the difference between it and our right-hand side, then it's a small enough difference so that, yeah, this is an okay enough solution to our system of equations. The good things about iterative methods, the reason they've been the main way of solving our systems and numerical methods is that they're very good at working with sparse matrices, just because the only thing they really involve is the product of your matrix times a vector, or the product of the transpose times a vector. You're not decomposing your matrix whatsoever. So they work well with sparse matrices, and so that's a big advantage for us. The disadvantage is that even if you have multiple matrix equations all with the same matrix, different right-hand sides, if you use an iterative solver, each time you have a new right-hand side, you have to start your solution from scratch, essentially. So there's no extra nice, neat time savings as there is for LU decomposition. Okay, so almost at the end of today's class. So the obvious exercise, if you folks are so inclined, is to write up code using all the bits that I gave you here today to do a 1D solution, do a solution to the 1D MT problem, come up with the electric field. I've got the Fortran code that I coded up to generate the picture that I showed you, so I'd be quite happy to show you that if you don't quite feel like coding it up yourselves, but it's not all that difficult and not too time-consuming to actually go ahead and code it. So the final slide for today, the concluding slide. I mean, what I talked about, the solution I gave you today was finite difference solution, and very much derived it, presented it to you sort of based on intuition and this approximating our derivatives in terms of these finite differences. And for the discretization that I gave you, especially with the electric field at the center of the specified at the center of the layers, then once you've got your derivatives approximated, then everything else kind of falls out in an intuitive, obvious manner. And so this is, we're just taking our differential equation. We're doing our finite differences to approximate our differential equation at each particular point, in our z-axis. And so that's us approximating our differential equation. And then that just gives us a whole sequence, a whole stack of equations, which we need to solve, simultaneous equations that we need to solve. And if we do, then we'll end up getting our approximate value of the electric field at all the nodes such that our system of approximate equations are satisfied. Okay, so that's it for this class, folks. Any questions? Any comments? see. Not sure who's looking in the outside world. But was that, how understandable was that? Let's see, okay, we'll do the class participation. Who in this class did not understand a thing that was presented today? Sean doesn't count. Well, no, so like everybody understood something. But I mean, yeah, I mean, we can say, well, I'm quite happy to talk about this or not in different ways. And for sure, I mean, if anybody does want to try the example, because it's not very hard at all, then I'd be happy to sit through that with you if you want or not. I must admit, the bit of code that I have and brought with me actually uses, I mean, it's good and it's bad. It's good in that I used sparse matrices to solve it. So I used that SparseKit, good library. So it's a good example of how to use that, how to use sparse matrices. However, that does mean that the code I brought is considerably more complicated than it need be for simply solving the 1D problem. Because for the 1D problem, memory is not an issue. You can just form your matrix that's full of zeros except for the diagonal and just stick them in MATLAB and do it the obvious way and come up with a solution in not too long at all.
Colin, so the iterative solvers and the LU decomposition are only necessary if you're trying to be clever and avoid including all your zeros in your...
They're essentially the two ways of solving, the two gross different ways of solving your system of equations. So even in MATLAB, if you form the matrix, form a right-hand side, and say solve, and then buried within what it's doing will be one or the other. And probably for a nice small system, it could easily get away with just doing Gaussian elimination. So that's kind of the normal, obvious way of doing it. The iterative methods are not nearly as powerful. I mean, they're approximate, they're iterative. For really nice situations, they probably are guaranteed to converge and in not an insane number of iterations, but they're not good in terms of a powerful dynamic sort of solver. The only reason they are good is because they work with sparse matrices. And you can consider attempting to solve a system of equations that you know is 10,000 square or 100,000 square or bigger. And once you start getting up to that size of a system, there's no way you're going to have enough memory on your computer to use LU decomposition. How many folks are doing, either are doing or are contemplating writing code to do some numerical stuff as part of your work? Again, a little quick survey. Or are most of you just kind of using other people's code? Okay. A show of hands, quick show of hands. Who in the room is not writing any code, no matter how small, of their own? So who's not writing any code? Okay. Who in the room is not using other people's codes? Okay. Who in the room, trying to phrase a question to actually get so that people have to stick their hand up in the air. But so how many people are using some 2D empty inversion code routinely? Yeah, okay. So how many, I mean, do you know what the forward solver is doing, even crudely, in those codes? I mean, the hidden question is, do you care or not, of course, but assuming that we sort of ignore that question, I mean, because that's the other part of this course is me not to, I mean, okay, this was completely looking at the details of the 1D problem today, just so that if you want to go and code it, it's all there, everything's in the PDF file, essentially. And in the later classes, I'm going to rely a lot on the 1D problems as well, because I can actually draw the line showing where the nodes are and where the layer interfaces are and kind of assemble things if you're wanting to go ahead and do it. So I'm relying heavily on 1D. But all this stuff can be applied. All the stuff that I show you are the same concepts that are used in the 2D and 3D codes to actually do their numerical solutions. So arguably the main part of this course is not to get you folks up and coding this stuff. It's so that if you're sitting in front of your Randy Mackey's code for 3D forward modeling or 2D inversion, that you've got some idea, some inkling as to how his forward solver works, for example, or some of the other codes just. And hopefully to give you an idea of what's going on, a bit of an understanding of what's going on from the sort of the principles of what this numerical modeling of this EM induction stuff is, but also just sort of the practical limitations. Why all of a sudden the code might not work anymore if you've increased the size of your mesh from, and I don't know what the numbers are, but instead of 50 by 100, you stick in an extra 10 cells on the end and oops, all of a sudden it's not working or it's taking twice as long, then how might those extra cells have impacted the numerical computations that are going on, for example? And in that scenario, if you increase the number of cells, then oops, all of a sudden you're probably requiring more memory than you actually have on your computer, so doesn't work, falls over. Or because you're using an iterative solver, increase the size of the mesh, increase the size of the problem, it's going to take longer to iterate to get your iterative solution of an adequate accuracy and those kind of things. Okay, I'm going to stop talking right here and now, and for sure available for questions. But also, 2 o'clock again tomorrow, I guess, same place, same time.